and this is New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. For over 150 years, the office worker has held a special place in the American psyche. From the Dickensian clerk Bob Cratchit and a determined Melanie Griffith in the movie Working Girl to the office indignation suffered by the popular cartoon character Dilbert, Americans have been preoccupied with the idea of work. In a new book, author Nikhil Saval takes that preoccupation one step further with a look at how the evolution of the office has shaped the lives of the millions of workers who inhabit it each day. Saval offers a sweeping study of how developments in the economy, technology, architecture, interior design, the behavioral sciences, and even pop culture have combined to define the physical environment of the office, while reflecting the experiences of those working within it. Saval's insights are especially timely at a moment when the digital revolution is once again redefining our idea of the workplace. Today on The Exchange, a conversation with author Nikhil Saval about his new book on the history of the workplace. Let's hear from you. How does the office environment shape your work? What are some of your most interesting office experiences? What changes would you make to how we conceive of the American workplace? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And if you email us a picture of your cubicle, we'll post it on our website. Send those pictures to exchange@nhpr.org. And joining me from Philadelphia this morning is Nikhil Saval. He's an editor for the Literature, Culture, and Politics magazine, N+1, and author of the new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. And Nikhil, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Nikhil, I enjoyed reading your book very much. And from my own work experiences over the past 30 years, I really identified with a lot of what you write about the evolution of the office environment. So let me start by asking you, what made you decide to write a book about the office? You know, the office is ubiquitous, but it's not necessarily an obvious topic.
Well, it was maybe precisely that, the fact that it was ubiquitous and just not very covered. I mean, it really started when I got my first office job. I was working straight out of college in a large corporate publishing house. It's named, I don't want to tell you the name of
sure,
it, but it was,
fine.
I'll just say that it was named after a certain tuxedo-colored species of Arctic animal. But
there's a hint.
I want to hide names. But it was just a very large kind of very traditional corporate publishing house, corridor offices around the side, cubicles in the center. And I had a cubicle, and I thought I was participating in this great universal cultural experience, my first cubicle. And you know, I was very interested in it. I was excited by it. And over time, as I got used to my job and indeed started to dislike it a little bit and started to really feel that I, in some way, was kind of a powerless individual. I was always scared about, you know, I would talk to people who were scared about getting fired, or I knew people who would get fired, just sort of arbitrarily. I just started to realize that there was some way in which my space, this kind of open, flimsy stall, and, you know, the arrangement of offices around, or in the place in general, somehow reflected a certain kind of arrangement of power. And that, it was that kind of, that sort of mixture, that confluence of ideas, that vague confluence, that got me thinking about why it was like this, why we worked the way we did, whether it had always been this way. And I started kind of looking. I just started doing some informal research, and I realized there was a whole history that actually a lot of, you know, very few people had really written about. So that was where it came out of.
Yeah, and your background in publishing helps me to understand why there's a really interesting kind of literary flavor to the book. I mean, you seem to combine elements of you know, design theory and architecture with kind of a real feel for how the office has fit into our literature, our movies, our pop culture, and I think that's what makes this book unusual to read.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the office, you know, is such a huge experience for a statistically quite a large number of people, and yet it's there's something about it that actually forbids looking at it too closely. And so there are waves of kind of literature and or films, I think, that examine certain aspects of office experience. So, you know, in the early 20th century, you had a lot of books about women entering the workplace. And then in the mid-century, a lot of books about sort of organization men, middle managers, the man in the gray flannel suit. And then closer to our own time, things like Office Space, where they're about insecurity, layoffs, tech companies, things like that. And so you find these kind of attempts to grapple with the experience at the same time that it's very hard to. There's something about office work that is not that exciting to write about, and so you have to kind of figure out ways to do it. But people have definitely tried. There's quite a lot to look at.
Yeah, so the culture really reflects the experience in the actual space. There are a number of one thing I liked about the book is you have these different themes that you keep coming back to in the different chapters. And so there are these kind of competing themes that all combine to propel the physical concept of the office forward. And no surprise to me, probably the biggest is technology. So let's start there. Just maybe the highlights of the ways in which technology has had an impact on the evolution of the office, and also not only the office, but how work itself is done.
Right. So, you know, in the earliest sort of offices, to speak about technology is probably not really apropos. I mean, one has, you know, you have it's very face to face. There are no phones. There's no telegraphs. There's, you know, nothing of that kind. And so the offices are small, and they're often connected very directly to the kind of factories or spaces that where there people are doing, you know, people are doing paperwork in a way for a larger manual operation. And this really changes with the invention of communications devices. That starts to change things. So you have the telegraph, you have the telephone, you just have you have ways that allow the separation of the places where people do the paperwork from the places where people do the manual work. You no longer have to, you know, literally go and talk to and see how, you know, work is getting done on the shop floor. You can just put in a phone call or send a telegraph. Or, you know, the other thing that changes is the invention of things like steel frames for architecture, elevators. Those things start to permit the construction of much larger office spaces. And so overall what starts to happen is growth and enlargement of the space as well as the separation of
right.
the space.
I think that separation is kind of one of the big themes, that increasingly the managers and the people doing the paperwork no longer needed to be on site because you could reach them using this technology.
Yeah, and that has an effect on the sense of the office as an office. I mean, in the earliest days, people called them counting houses. I mean, in a way, that's very, very literal. This is where you count your money, or you count how much, you know, what the bill's coming in. And then it's when they start to get separated that the actual term office becomes more useful. And it actually kind of coincidentally, around the same time that downtown comes into usage, you have office districts, you have business districts. And that's when people, you know, also start to think of office work as like a separate class institution, a separate status group. So in that way, technology enables the notion of office work and office workers as not quite workers in the same way that manual workers or factory workers were.
Right. And we'll talk a little bit also about, obviously, when we talk about the future, computers and the internet, which has had a colossal impact on how we do work. A quick aside, I wanted to ask you about one of my favorite items of the Office of the Evolution, the pneumatic tube. I remember as a child being in some older office buildings and seeing these crazy looking networks of tubes. It sounded like it was a good idea at the time. Talk a little bit about those.
Yeah, I mean, actually, if anyone has seen the recent film The Wolf of Wall Street, you see that the pneumatic tube being used very early on in that film, and that's from the 1980s, where they make a deal and he puts the deal in the pneumatic tube. The pneumatic tube, in a way, it's again a kind of thing that, like, I guess the another kind of example would be the dictaphone,
right?
Where it's able to separate, you know, certain kinds of operations. You can fulfill an order. You put it in a pneumatic tube to another portion of the office. It allows certain kinds of work to be separated, and it also kind of makes office work a little bit more factory-like. I mean, there were lots of things that did that in the early 20th century. The typewriter was one of them. It's just because you suddenly have a machine-like operation to your work. You have to, as opposed to making it sort of mental or thought-based. You're just slamming things into tubes and sending them all over the place.
Right. It kind of imposes sort of a structural uniformity on the overall office space.
Exactly.
A special aspect of technology that we should at least mention is the advent of the skyscraper. And I was mentioning to you before the show that I lived in downtown Chicago for a number of years, right in this South Loop neighborhood where some of the very earliest skyscrapers, early steel frame buildings were built, really fundamentally transforms how people do work and the whole concept of office space.
Yeah, I mean, the skyscraper is, it's funny, it's also important to point out that it's a pretty American phenomenon. I mean, I think in many European cities, the density of the original cities, just there was a kind of just a aversion to building that high, and that's still the case in most of them. The skyscraper, I mean, you know, in the earliest days, you could only really build about five stories. Someone referred to the universal... Architectural historian referred to the universal human disinclination to walk up more than five flights of stairs.
Right. And
it was, you know, it was also difficult to construct buildings that were higher with the kinds of masonry construction that was available at the time. But then with iron frames and then later steel frames, suddenly you have the capacity to build much higher. And this becomes a testament, you know, to a certain kind of human ingenuity and also to the prowess and just soaring power of American capitalism in the Gilded Age. And so people just sort of try to outdo themselves in the attempt to build skyscrapers. In Chicago, as you mentioned, I mean, that area had been cleared. A lot of it had been cleared by fire that allowed the construction of a very pure kind of business district. And so you have like the clustering of lots of different kind of
right.
skyscrapers.
I used to love walking through that neighborhood and seeing the transition from brick to steel. We need to take a quick break, but we'll have more on the secret history of the workplace with author Nikhil Saval right after the break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. You can join Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts who will be taking your questions as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. The Exchange on the Road is happening at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem on Thursday, July 10th. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. More on Cubed, a secret history of the workplace on The Exchange, then a 10 on the Diane Room Show, Airbnb, Uber, and the future of the sharing economy. Clouding up today, chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon with some gusty winds and heavy rainfall, hot and humid highs today, upper 80s to lower 90s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Taylor Cottrell in New London, setting investment goals and managing portfolios for clients in 20 states. Information at taylorcottrell.com. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, a sustainable system improving the health of our communities for generations to come. Imagine.d-h.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at the evolution of the office and the office worker. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And also, if you send us a picture of your cubicle, we'll post it on our website. And you can send those pictures to exchange@nhpr.org. And today we're talking about the evolution of the office with Nikhil Saval. Nikhil is an editor at the print and digital magazine N+1, and he's author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. And Nikhil, we were talking a bit about architecture and how that fundamentally transformed how work was done, which leads me to my next question about efficiency. It seems like throughout the book, one of the themes, and there are these sort of periodic moments throughout history where there's a real focus on how design affects efficiency, the desire to increase efficiency. And it really seems like it's all about optimizing the flow of paperwork.
Yeah, this really, you know, there's a kind of cult of efficiency that takes place around the turn of the, you know, at the start of the 20th century, largely due to, you know, there's a sudden increase in the amount of bureaucracy. Suddenly, businesses get really big at that time. The influence of the railroads, of trusts, of the advent of the American corporation means that there's suddenly a lot more paperwork to do. And this results, at least for a while, in a kind of chaos. I mean, the office at that point is new. People don't really know what to do with them. And it's this kind of need to organize American business at this time that leads to the first kind of efficiency craze, which is scientific management. And its leader, Frederick Taylor, one of the kind of major American figures of the 20th century. I mean, his actual animus was really against factory work. He thought factory work was run inefficiently. People were not optimizing the amount of the motions or the time they took to do certain tasks. And so he, you know, put a huge emphasis on managers, really, a kind of class of managers who would study the work process and then rationalize it. They would standardize every tool. They would standardize every motion. They would standardize the amount of time it took to do anything. And this would be done in offices. So in a way, Taylor enlarged the office workforce and started to enlarge it eventually it kind of grew beyond the actual blue-collar workforce. And a lot of the kind of planning and work was done in offices. At the same time, this operation needed to be streamlined in turn. And so you had Taylor acolytes, measuring the fastest time to lick envelopes, the fastest time to file documents. You know, they would put office workers in competition with each other, turn things into a kind of game. Like, how fast can you lick those envelopes? I bet you can't do it as fast as that other office worker. These figures became were so famous actually in the American imagination, they became kind of pop cultural figures. If you know the film Cheaper by the Dozen, where people rationalize their own families. I mean, this came out of a whole movement, really, to rationalize the flow of work, largely in offices.
And this sort of leads to a whole revolution in the design of furniture, building layouts. You talk about the advent of ergonomics. Say a little bit about that kind of developing furniture to go with kind of the maximum efficiency in human movement.
Yeah, so the... the initial change in furniture is an attempt to make office work easier to monitor. So the earlier desks, one of the earliest clerical desks was the Wooten desk, which was it was filled with cubby holes. It was a kind of desk that you could bury into or burrow into rather. And then for the new efficiency craze, the modern efficiency desk was made of steel or cheaper metal. Rather, and it was flat. You could walk over it as a manager and surveil it. But over time, people started to realize that these kinds of chairs and desks were not actually very comfortable. A lot of people were increasingly sitting in these chairs for hours on end, working at typewriters. If you were in the steno pool, you were just there all the time in a way that you weren't in early offices. And so you have people starting to work on chairs or desks that actually reflect human movement. In the early 20th century, the notion of a standing desk, which is super popular now, of course, was first introduced. It was real. At the time, people thought that toxins would settle in the bodies of typists if they sat too long. It was too expensive to actually institute. But that's, there are basic movements to... basically, to study the behavior of office workers as they actually behave, rather than trying to legislate how they should behave, and that's where ergonomics comes from. Trying to fit the shape of desks and chairs and things like that to the actual needs of human workers, and that really starts to take off by the sort of mid-century. That's when you have like a real emphasis on design in that. Mode.
Yeah, ergonomics is something that is in probably every facet of life today. Nikhil, let's go to the phones. We have Steve calling in from Nottingham. Steve, welcome to the exchange. Steve, are you there?
Hello,
Steve?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Welcome to the exchange.
Okay, I want to make two observations. One is that I'm a psychiatrist, and the office hasn't changed one bit for me, and neither do I want it to change. It's me and a patient listening, and we need privacy. We need a couple chairs, a box of Kleenex, and that's all we really need and should need. Door number two is one of the things that I've seen happen is the internet and email has actually corrupted human communication. I worked for a major company, and I was told to email someone about something whose office was right next to mine. And I said, I want to get out and talk to that person. No, you have to send an email. So I feel that email has actually circumvented human communication.
Steve, is a great comments. Nikhil, for some people, this has not had a huge impact on how they conduct their work. And of course, email is a topic that has had a big impact on how we do work.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the comment. It's true that in some ways, office work tends to there's a lot of discussion in office design of disruption, of change, of like the coming changes in the nature of work. And a lot has changed. I mean, the nature of communication and technology. But, you know, the comment about the privacy that the psychiatrist's office offers, I mean, that's one of the things in a way that's being lost as we rush to break down walls. I mean, the origin of the cubicle was kind of meant to increase communication and collaboration. But ultimately, what hasn't changed, if you look at surveys over the last 20 or 30 years, is that people prefer privacy and they need it. And so I think the caller actually is reflecting a certain kind of basic human preference for, you know, for privacy and also for and the ability to conduct that conversation face to face. I mean, I think phones, email, Facebook, I mean, that stuff, it allows people to leave offices and they don't have to stay there. But there is a kind of cost to that, which is that it increases the amount of it actually provides. You have to do a new kind of work. You suddenly have email. You're just kind of spending all day emailing or whatever. So it creates a new kind of inefficiency.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for that call. And today on The Exchange, we're talking about the evolution of the office and the office worker with Nikhil Saval. He's the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. And you can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR or email exchange at nhpr.org. And you can tell us about your office experiences. You can email us pictures of your cubicle to exchange at nhpr.org, and we'll post them on our website. And let us know what you think about the evolution of the American workplace. Nikhil, before we talked to Steve, we were talking about this idea of efficiency and optimizing the flow of work. And that kind of leads to my next topic, which is the idea of status. You know, one of the interesting, there's almost kind of a sad or bittersweet undercurrent through a lot of your book in which people come into the office, a white-collar job with increasingly highly educated in recent years and recent decades, with a sort of promise of upward mobility. And it seems to be a false promise at some level. So I want you to talk about that. But more generally on the issue of status, it's just a quick story from my own life. After college, I worked in a large corporate law firm with about a couple hundred lawyers. And status in that firm was almost completely defined for lawyers and legal assistants by the size and location of their office. And so whenever a senior partner would leave the firm or somebody would get promoted, it would set in place this sort of remarkable domino effect in which everybody switched offices. And because it was a big firm, it was almost there were moving companies in the firm almost on a weekly basis. And so say a little bit about status and this kind of idea of the promise of upward mobility.
Sure. So status is one of the kind of prestige of office work is one of the earliest themes that one locates. I mean, as soon as you start to look for the origins of office work in the 19th century, you start to there are a lot of testimonies to the kind of prestigiousness, the cleanliness of office work. I mean, compared with manual work, I mean, it's clean. You don't come home from work smelling of your work. You wear business attire. There's something about it that is especially attractive for that reason. And the other idea is that you enter from the bottom. There's always a promise of meritocracy in the office. That's at least the sort of ideology of it. You start at the bottom and then, you start in the steno pool or the typing, rather the cubicle, and you make your way to the corner office. That's the sort of idea. But as office work enlarges and as it becomes more and more of a sort of pyramid, that promise is more likely to be betrayed. I mean, there are fewer places at the top and more places at the bottom, so you're not likely to make your way all the way to the top. And so in a way, the office over the course of the 20th century has to manage this expectation. Designers in some ways, management theorists, businessmen, they have to somehow recognize the fact that people are going to enter the office with this expectation, and it's going to be frustrated. And they have to psychologically manage that. And one of the ways, like you mentioned, that they do that is through design. So the articulation of very small gradations in privilege, so that if you make it to be a middle manager from the center of the office, you have a certain kind of oak desk, but then you go a little bit higher and you move to a slightly larger office and you have carpet, or you have a mahogany desk. There was an ad by the company Bigelow, the carpet manufacturer, which was, the slogan was something like, a Bigelow on the floor rates a name on the door. That you get a Bigelow carpet, and that's the sign that you're on your way up. You're going to make it, and that ideology persists and has often been challenged. I think in the 1930s, for example, during the trough of the Great Depression, you suddenly had a lot of office workers realizing that wait a second, like, actually the status offered by office work is no great shakes. I just got laid off, and so you have a strong move towards unionization in office work, and this really scares people. This results in a way in a lot of the attempts to make office work it's a much more prestigious. The 1950s, the international style, the great glass office buildings like the Lever House and Seagram Building, like a lot of the kind of better designs, the better furniture of that period, is an attempt to psychologically manage the fact that these expectations are constantly being frustrated. So that's the issue, I think.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. My experience is exactly what you described. I would often try to figure out why a partner had switched offices, and it was usually something like maybe just a few extra square feet or a slightly better view. But it seemed like a lot of effort for not a big difference. But again, it's this issue of status. One other issue that is an ongoing theme in your book is the issue of gender and the huge impact that the changing roles of women have had in the evolution of the workplace. Say a little bit about that. I thought some of the distinctions between personal secretaries and women managers and the typing pool, just fascinating impact on the workplace.
Yeah, I mean, the entry of women into the office environment is one of the just most profound transformations in the 20th century. And it does have some connection, in fact, to status. What, you know, women entered during the Civil War, when a lot of men had exchanged their white collars for blue Union uniforms, and it was an experiment by the U.S. government, and then it turned out that women were quite good at the jobs that they were doing, and there was a plus, which was that there was no expectation that they had to be paid as much as men, and so women gradually started to fill a lot of the kind of menial occupations in the office. Especially the typing pool by sort of 1920, women were starting to approach a kind of a parity with men in the percentage of office workers, but they were by and large doing the kind of most menial work. You saw them they were in the center of these like caverns of offices doing just typing, steno work, sometimes accounting, and it was very lightly mechanical. And that was that was the expectation. And you would never, of course, rise out of that. You would either get married or get out or just be stuck there. The one exception to this was the personal secretary.
Right. The power of the personal secretary you talk about, that was really interesting. Yeah.
Exactly. And that was the one kind of prestigious job that you could have. That, too, was dead end. I mean, if you were personal secretary, you were not going to get out of that. But the idea was that you were satisfied with a kind of derivative status that acquired from working often for a really great boss or a really powerful boss. You were supposed to derive satisfaction from being the assistant, the kind of being a personal secretary was, some of the work was menial, but some of it was just managing your boss's whims or moods, or you were very close. You people called personal secretaries the office wives
right.
of their bosses because they spent more time with them often than the bosses did with their actual wives. And they, you know, and there was of course a lot of discussion of the kind of inevitable or possibly inevitable or the possible sexual tension that could arise from that kind of relationship. So it was, you know, it was the kind of most middle class of women's work, but it was, and in that sense, it was often the hardest to organize when women did try to organize secretarial workers in the 30s or the 70s.
And when do we really start to see women moving into the managerial ranks in large numbers?
You start to see that after the 1970s, largely. I mean, that comes about through concerted action, through organizing, after the passage of equal opportunity employment laws in response to the civil rights movement. You have women, you know, suing for that kind of for discrimination. You don't have the kind of idea of sexual harassment starts to enter the atmosphere, the notion that this is a kind of discrimination. I mean, that really takes off by the 90s. And then you have groups, secretarial organizations like the 9 to 5 movement. People probably know the film 9 to 5.
Is that Dolly Parton, right?
Yeah, Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda. That comes directly out of actual workers' experiences of trying to combat the discrimination of their bosses. And that leads to, you know, women actually plausibly starting to enter managerial ranks. And so then things like by the late 1980s, you have the film Working Girl. And that's an example of, you know, that's an example. It's an old story, the kind of ingenue who arrives in New York and or Manhattan and tries to make her way up. But she has a woman boss, Sigourney Weaver. And that's a new story at that time. And it comes directly out of these movements to combat the discrimination that kept women down.
And a big change, because earlier in the book you talk about how women office workers, personal secretaries were instructed to in these manuals to kind of gracefully accept and deal with sexual harassment, a big change over that century. We need to take one more break, but we'll keep talking with author Nikhil Saval on his new book, Cubed. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Airbnb, Uber, and the future of the sharing economy. Then singer-songwriter Natalie Merchant on her new album and her life in music. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather for today, clouding up, chance of some showers and thunderstorms this afternoon with some gusty winds and heavy rainfall, hot and humid highs today from upper 80s to lower 90s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Home Magazine, featuring outdoor living spaces on the water and in the garden. New Hampshire Home Magazine, design and decor for the home and garden. And from Froling Energy, providing and installing high-efficiency wood pellet and wood chip boilers for commercial and institutional space heating, online at frolingenergy.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange is our earlier show on the little-known story behind the Battle of Bunker Hill. But today on The Exchange, we're looking at the unexpectedly fascinating history of the workplace. And you can join us with your thoughts by calling at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can find us on Twitter at NHPR Exchange or find us on Facebook at NHPR Exchange, all one word, and you can continue the conversation there. Also, you can send us pictures of your office space or your workspace cubicle, and we'll post them on our website. That's exchange at NHPR.org. And Nikhil, the title of your book is Cubed, so I want you to say a bit about what is perhaps the most misunderstood and maligned design component of the modern workplace, and that's the cubicle. And I was fascinated to learn that the cubicle was originally conceived as a way to liberate the office worker. What went wrong?
Yeah, the cubicle was definitely designed to save office workers from an environment that the original design of the cubicle found abhorrent. I mean, if you think about you know, the way the inventor of the cubicle was a guy named Robert Probst. He was a kind of maniacally inventive, brilliant figure, not a kind of autodidact designer. And he was hired by Herman Miller to design anything. And he got obsessed with the office and its inefficiencies. I mean, he you know, the office at that time, people are familiar with it, I think, from images, even if they haven't worked in one, was the kind of corridor offices around the manager offices in the corridor and the steno pool in the center. If you've seen Mad Men or The Apartment, you know the image. And Probst thought this was a wasteland. You know, he as we've been saying earlier in the show, it was purely based on status, on levels of prestige. You got an office if you, or you got a certain kind of office if you had, you know, made it up the corporate hierarchy, but it didn't reflect your actual work. And so Probst was trying to come up with a design that would provide some measure of flexibility, of autonomy to the workers in the center. I mean, and you know, he also thought that there was a new kind of worker coming into being, which he following Peter Drucker, the management theorist, he called knowledge workers, people who were doing tasks of judgment rather than sort of mechanical tasks. This was aided by computerization, by the automation of certain kind of lightly mechanical tasks. And the design he came up with, he called it the action office, and the emphasis was really on action, was meant to enhance workers' movement, to enhance their kind of the flow of work and workers' own sense of their individuality and autonomy. And it came out in 1968. It was a very 60s-ish design, actually. And it consisted of three obtusely angled interlocked walls, fabric-wrapped. It was very kind of lightly designed, the idea being that workers could personalize the designs themselves. They could pin things to it. And it was... It was, you know, and the idea was also that it was flexible. It could be reshaped to any given requirement. And this was received at the time. I mean, it's sort of hard to believe, but it was received at the time as a kind of revelation. People thought that there was no better way to do work. It was amazing that no one had come up with work this way. A New York Post reporter said, you know, office workers, beware. You may suddenly be able to work at 100% efficiency. The action office is coming, and it was this huge hit, and it became copied by all these companies, Steelcase, Hayworth, all the other furniture companies, and it was just packed into offices. People, it was very cheap as well to do this, as opposed
to flexible,
and flexible, right? And that's when things started to go wrong. I mean, it suddenly became clear. You know, Probst started to view this as a kind of with horror that people were using his action office or variations on it to cram as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, into as little space as possible for as little money as possible. And that's when the action office became a box and the cube shaped sort of monster that we know today.
Yeah, I encourage our listeners to Google action office and maybe look at some of the pictures. The early designs from the 60s are really quite cool if you're into design, and very colorful and kind of minimalist. And you know, you talk about the idea kind of being perverted by managers into something a lot less hospitable. I have to say, in the 1980s, my wife worked in a big insurance firm located in a skyscraper, and she would occasionally ask me to stop by her office, and she would always say, just meet me at my six-pack. We'll talk about a six-pack. And it was mind-boggling. It literally was a football field of fabric-wrapped cubicles, really a giant labyrinth. And, you know, she would stand up and I'd see her hand, you know, halfway across the field waving at me to bring me down the maze. Certainly not what Probst had intended.
No, I mean, by the late 90s, just 2 years before his death, he was interviewed. I mean, he had become known by that point as the father of the office cubicle, which he had never intended. And people asked him, what do you think of Dilbert? And he just disavowed a sense of responsibility. At the same, you know, he said, I was trying to save people from that kind of world. At the same time that he acknowledged that people were not as enlightened as he expected. I think he had a kind of conception of business that. In which people had workers' interests in mind, they had their needs in mind, and in fact, they had their bottom line in mind, and that's what created the
case. Right. It seems like the financial incentives kind of worked at cross purposes to the sort of aesthetic concern about the office worker experience.
Exactly. Yeah.
We haven't talked yet about the future, you know, internet, computers. We're really now in a world while, you know, there are in many places these kinds of office spaces still both in the city and out in the suburbs and these suburban campuses. But for a lot of people, the workplace is no longer tethered to physical office space. You do talk a little bit, you know, we all know about the Googleplex and the Apple campus. They're about to build some amazing new building out in Silicon Valley. Talk about where we are now and where you think we're headed.
You have there in some ways are two directions that one seems to be going with the office. And one is precisely that, the kind of enhancement or of the office as this campus, as this place that you or where you're supposed to enjoy going. I mean, this is fairly exceptional, but these are the most sort of famous or iconic offices of our time, like the Googleplex, like the Norman Foster design for Apple. Frank Gehry is designing the new Facebook campus, and the idea is that behind those offices, and I visited a couple of them, is that you are meant to go there, and you're in a way meant to stay there. And they provide amenities. They provide basically any kind of service that you need, including doctors, the gym, getting your oil changed. And it's the idea is that you're more productive on campus, and you do better when you are running into people on campus. You do better when you're having these sort of informal interactions. I mean, this was one of the reasons that Marissa Mayer insisted that Yahoo workers should come into work. At the same time, that also it diverges from the experience of a lot of office workers, which is the increasing temporal casualization of work. Temping, freelancing, a certain kind of insecurity is much more common in other kinds of offices. The notion that you might not be there for a few years. People switch jobs constantly. They're laid off constantly. And they're also, and this corresponds to a technological situation where you don't actually have to come in to do a lot of work. The caller earlier in the show was mentioning just the rise of email. That just means that's one of the many reasons that you can kind of work from home, you can work from a cafe, you can work from a co-working facility where you actually pay to get a desk. So you have the you might call it the disaggregation of the office, the kind of bleaking out of the office from the building envelope into all areas of life. In a way, when you look at a lot of American cities, you see a lot of spaces being turned into ad hoc office spaces. People can kind of do work anywhere, and they're increasingly forced to do that. They increasingly are
coffee shops.
To do that.
I know in some cities, hotel lobbies are very popular places to work and meet people.
Right. Airports, things like that. Those are all just being turned into. It's natural in a way that people expect to do their work in these places.
I want to let our listeners know you can still call in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Tell us about your own office experience. And we're talking today with Nikhil Saval. He's author of the book Cubed, which talks all about the evolution of the office. And office work. You mentioned the one example of sort of the non-office work, this disaggregation. It seems to be raising a host of new potential issues. Again, I mentioned, my wife in the cubicle six-pack in the mid-'80s. Today, most of her work is at home in an office on a video conference with colleagues located all around the globe. And that has raised a set of issues. It really kind of blurs the line between work and family, even though people are disconnected from a physical office. You no longer go to work and come home.
Yeah, it's in a way this is like a kind of liberation in some ways. I mean, people, office environments have long been loathed in the last 20 years. I mean, there's a kind of conception of the office as a tedious place. And so it should be exciting in a way that we have that there's a broader consensus on the flexibility of work, and that people should be able to do their work whatever environment best suits the kind of work they need to do. If you don't need to go into an office, or if you don't need to have a meeting in person, you could just video conference, and then it that kind of makes handling family duties or handling personal life easier. At least it should, in theory. And actually, I mean, the experience of many people is that is precisely the opposite, is that it's suddenly become very, very difficult to separate the two things. And this especially, and this is especially very gendered. I mean, to the extent that women are still largely doing much domestic labor or taking care of children, that there's a sense of overwhelmingness that where you just are not able to separate your work at any given time. And that, in a way, that still corresponds to the fact that power in white-collar workplace situations, whether you're in an office or not, is very unequal. And so there's an expectation that you need to be on all the time, that you need to do your work all the time. And this, because your work is not very secure, you're not likely to, you rarely have a union, you rarely have job protections, you could be laid off at any given point, you could, or if you're a freelancer, you need to keep getting contracts. And so I think that's part of, you know, that in a way, technology has enabled that, but it's also the basic underlying power situation that enables this, that produces this sense of anxiety that I think a lot of us feel.
Yeah, it really is kind of a sense of anxiety. That's a great word for it. You know, I have for many years vacationed at a particular resort, and for many years they would refuse to have Wi-Fi, email. You know, basically the idea was to offer people an opportunity to tune out. And sure enough, about 5-6 years ago, they gave in, and now all the accommodations have Wi-Fi. There are internet terminals available for people to use. And I do see people working on their iPads and their laptops when they're supposed to be on vacation with their families.
Yeah, in a way, people – I mean, I spoke to some designers who mentioned – I mean, who – like in the Netherlands, where they're actually quite – they've been quite progressive about flexibility in design and were early in adopting policies where you didn't have to go to work. And they talked about how people have to be trained out of not working all the time. I mean, it's a situation that in a way is only going to get worse unless we – and I personally, I mean, I'm subject to these same anxieties. I work more than I would like to or very inefficiently as well. And it's not good. I mean, it's not good mentally. It's not good for our sense of sanity. I mean, everyone knows this experience, and so there have to. It's in a way, something else has to change. There's some way in which our sense of needing to work all the time is tied to something else. The sense that we need to do not. It's certainly not pleasurable. I mean, it's something that we are doing in some ways to ensure that we have a sense of stability and security elsewhere in our lives.
So you talk about this kind of divergence between these paternal campuses like the Googleplex and the untethering from the office of the American worker, you know, freelance work, less job security. Just a couple minutes left, and I'm curious, you know, you talk to a lot of these design experts and prognosticators. Do you have any sense, or do they give you any sense where we might be headed next? Is the internet really the final frontier, or is there something else that people who study this stuff have their eye on?
Yeah, I think the internet is certainly changing the ability to work, you know, where you can work. But I think the real emphasis now is on increasing the interpersonal actions and spaces. I think there's a lot of emphasis on being able to work together. Collaboration is a really strong buzzword, and so designers speak a lot about the importance of face-to-face interactions. So actually, those suddenly become more meaningful, and offices themselves become more about culture, about people getting together. The rise of things like co-working facilities, where you pay for a desk, I mentioned. I mean, that's a very astonishing thing. I mean, I think people who don't need to go into an office often find themselves wanting to, just to escape certain kinds of isolation that online work or the internet engenders. So in a way, what's happening, what designers have told me, is that the office in some ways needs to justify itself more, that offices become more about sociability and less and less about, you know, having to be there and that's where you have to do your work. I think that's what you see in the future of the office, is that offices, there probably will need to be fewer of them, or they need to be used more efficiently. And what they need to be used for is precisely for this, for culture, for meanings, for people to get out of isolation.
Yeah, and in a way, that's kind of goes back to a much earlier theme in your book, this idea of the kind of fortuitous encounter, which was something that's, you know, part of the creative process. And this sounds like kind of a 21st century of creating environments in which that's a possibility.
That's right, yeah. And I don't know, it's that seems to be the kind of way where things are going, where people going to offices precisely to run into other people. I think that's what they've become for, and that's kind of what they were always good at. I think that's that may be a return to an earlier idea of what the office was for.
That's right. Well, we are out of time, and I know we're all going to continue to watch the evolution of the American workspace to see where it goes next. It's certainly going to affect all of us. I want to let our listeners know you can continue to take your photos and send them to us, and we'll post them on our website. Send them to exchange@nhpr.org, your workspace or your cubicle. And I'd like to thank my guest, Nikhil Saval, for joining us to talk about the impact of the office on our lives. Nikhil, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
That's Nikhil Saval. He's an editor for the Literature, Culture, and Politics magazine, N+1, and author of the new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. He joined us from Philadelphia this morning. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier conversation on why more young people are ruling against law school. After years of a so-called lawyer bubble with firms expanding rapidly, these days many new graduates struggle to get a job in the legal profession. So now law school enrollment numbers are plummeting, leading some institutions to scale back and many to rethink how best to deliver that Juris Doctorate. Join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from the 81st Annual League of New Hampshire Craftsmen's Fair, August 1st through the 10th at the Mount Sunapee Resort in Newbury. Information online at nhcrafts.org. And Birchill Terrace, a continuing care retirement community in Manchester, fostering healthy aging by offering independent living, assisted living, and nursing care. Birchillterrace.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. More and more consumers are turning to Uber to hail rides with their smartphones or renting spare rooms from strangers online through Airbnb. These enterprises typify the sharing economy where everyone can be a micro-entrepreneur.